So there are lots of things that can compromise the stability of the global financial system, especially during a global pandemic.
So I mentioned supply chain disruption, shortages of material, the risk of a mooring inflation expectation. Another channel that investors have been focusing on is increasing house prices.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards, and in this episode, we dig into the latest Global Financial Stability Report, which tries to make sense of some pretty unexpected trends.
The interesting part is that usually house prices, historically at least, tend to drop during recession. But in this case, during the pandemic, they actually surge. My name is Fabio Nadalucci. I'm a deputy director in the Monitoring Capital Markets Department of the International Monetary Fund. I'm responsible for the Global Financial Stability Report, one of the flagship of the fund, as well as the Global Financial Markets Monitoring.
So where are we compared to the last financial stability report that was published back in April?
So the world is continuing to navigate the pandemic, and financial stability risk so far has been contained, right? That's reflect ongoing monetary and fiscal policy support, and obviously the rebound of the global economy. Now, in advanced economies, financial conditions have eased in addition further since the April 21 Global Financial Stability Report, supported by expectation that monetary policy will remain accommodative for the foreseeable future. So we have seen increase in equity prices. We've seen credit spread tightening even more. We have seen house prices rising rapidly in many countries. Now, despite some of this improvement, though, financial vulnerabilities remain elevated in a number of sectors. And the concern is that if there is a sudden repricing of risk in markets, for example, as investors reassess the outlook for the economy or for policy, that repricing of risk could interact with financial vulnerabilities. In emerging markets, financial conditions have changed little. We have seen virus mutation. We have seen uneven access to vaccine posing a threat to the economic recovery. They also face funding pressures. They face inflationary pressure. In some cases, central banks have actually tightened monetary policy. Credit conditions have improved in the corporate sector, but it's still in an uneven way. We have seen corporate balance sheet strengthening. We have seen profitability improving. Defaults and bankruptcy have declined, but there are still differences across countries, firm size, and sector. So, for example, solvency risk have remained elevated in sectors that have been hit by the pandemic and smaller firms. And in China, credit conditions have tightened, particularly for firms with weak credit ratings and provinces with weak public finances.
So last time we talked a lot about the unintended consequences of all the money that governments were using to support the various aspects of their economies. Have any of those unintended consequences actually materialized? And do we still need to worry about that?
Yeah, so now we are about a year and a half into the pandemic. And I think policymakers are facing a challenging trade-off here. Right. So there's a need to maintain near-term support for the global economy, but at the same time prevent these unintended consequences and medium-term financial stability risk that could put growth at risk. Right. So a prolonged period of very easy financial condition, while may be needed to sustain the economic recovery, especially if the strength of the economic recovery turned out to be less than anticipated, may result in overly stretched asset valuation, could fuel financial vulnerabilities that I just mentioned, some of the examples, right? There are some warning signs looking at, for example, increased financial risk-taking, rising fragilities in the non-bank financial institution sector. All these points to a deterioration in the underlying financial stability foundation. And so if this vulnerability evolved into legacy structural problems, they could put growth at risk in the medium term, or even at the extreme, test the resilience of the global financial system. And now the possible deterioration of the outlook could make this trade-off even more challenging. Or, for example, if inflation turned out to be more persistent than anticipated, at that point, central bank would face a challenging trade-off between having to raise interest rates if needed to contain inflation, but at the same time, slowing down the economic recovery.
So we're all experiencing supply chain disruptions to a certain degree. We hear a lot about semiconductors and chemicals and glass that are affecting manufacturing and, the things that we're not finding on grocery store shelves. How does all this fit into financial stability on a global scale?
So price pressures still continue to be viewed as largely driven by pandemic-related circumstances. So supply disruption, surging commodity prices, right? Look at the energy crisis in Europe and China, for example, shortages of components and labor. But despite that, concern about inflation risk seems to have intensified during the last few weeks in financial markets. And the concern is that an abrupt sustained increase in interest rate from currently low levels, particularly in the US, could trigger a tightening global financial condition and a pullback of risk-taking that could spill over to emerging markets. Now, what are the channels that investors seem to have in mind? One is the underlying dynamic of inflation, right? Whether some of these pandemic-related circumstances may fit into the dynamic of inflation going forward. Second channel is whether wage pressure. So we have seen increase in wages and whether this increase in wages may be passed on to prices, so translate into higher prices. And then importantly, whether there is what the central banker will call an unmooring or de-anchoring of inflation expectation. Essentially, investor and household raise their expectation of inflation for the future. And this is where the supply chain disruption, energy price increase may fit into some of this dynamic. Now, the question is, what are markets telling us about the inflation outlook, both in terms of market pricing as well as in terms of inflation survey? In terms of market prices, what we call inflation break-even, you see a notable increase since the lows during the pandemic. That's something that you would expect, right? So in part because of liquidity issue, those inflation break-even have declined sharply, and we have seen a rebound of those inflation break-even. Those are like market-based measure of inflation expectation. Now, what we call the front end, so say at the five-year horizon, that is importantly driven by the rebound in the economy, as well as higher commodity prices. So that's something you would expect. The question is whether you see also an increase in what we call the five-year forward, so between year 5 and year 10 of this market-based measure of inflation expectation, because that's much more directly linked to the inflation target of central bank. And so we do see some increase in that, but they're sort of like plateau in some range. And that's true for the US, it's true for the euro area. So important to distinguish between the five-year move and the more longer-term move. Now, another way to look at this is to look at surveys, and you get a similar information. You see an increase in the one-year, two-year, three-year survey-based measure of inflation expectation, but expectation beyond that seems to be much more well-anchored. Now, we also see an emerging market pressure in emerging markets, right? Similar manner than advanced economies. For the median emerging market, for example, inflation has risen about 1.5 percentage point above the median central bank target. But if you look beyond that, forward survey estimates show that inflation is still anticipated to come down, right? And so, in fact, if you had a five-year horizon, expectations are still well anchored, even for emerging markets. Now, why those are concerns are important in terms of policy? I mean, the concern is that this upside risk to the inflation outlook that I've identified may have implication for policies. Like, and so I mentioned supply chain disruption, shortages of material, the risk of a mooring inflation expectation. Another channel that investors have been focusing on is increasing house prices. And so how the recent surge in house prices may put upward pressure on inflation via rising rent costs. Now, from a policy standpoint, if inflation turned out to be more persistent than anticipated by investor and policymaker, the risk, again, is this inflation expectation may become a more, and then this reaction of central bank or monetary authorities will take center stage and will be closely scrutinized, particularly for central banks like the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank. They have recently introduced new frameworks.
So as you just mentioned there, we have seen house prices on the rise in many countries. In fact, the World Economic Outlook just out today shows that 2021 had the highest annual growth rate in 15 years. And the recent news about a Chinese real estate giant in trouble has made many people nervous, given what happened in 2008. Are housing markets something we need to worry about at this point?
So the housing market has been particularly strong during the pandemic, right? Reflecting accommodative monetary policy, strong demand for single and multifamily homes, possibly reflecting a shift in preferences, right, for more space, and also limited supply. The interesting part is that usually house prices, historically at least, tend to drop during recession. But in this case, during the pandemic, they actually surge across major advanced and emerging market economies. Right? In some countries, take, I don't know, Luxembourg, New Zealand, Turkey, real house prices actually have risen more than 15% since the end of 2019.
Wow.
Now, importantly here, what has been an important boost has been fiscal support, right? And the improving economic outlook. They pushed up in personal incomes, and they helped contain the increase in home price to disposable income. There's also a supply story here. So potential imbalance between demand and supply that could explain some of this trend. Supply has been slow to respond to demand. We have seen pandemic-related bottlenecks, like shortages, rising costs of material and labor, prolonged construction time, delayed increase in supply, I don't know, limited building permits, for example, in metropolitan areas. So all this supply effect could be another contributing factor to the rise in house prices. Now, what we've done in the financial stability report, we looked at what we call downside risk to home prices, right? Extreme worst-case downside scenario. The reason being that usually sustained periods of growth in house prices can create the expectation that such price will continue to rise in the future, leading to excessive risk-taking and debt vulnerabilities. And so we're trying to quantify what are the downside risks to house prices. Again, looking at the worst-case scenario, in that case, our result shows that the house price decline over the next 3 years could be at the extreme again, in a worst-case scenario, 14% in advanced economies and 22% in emerging markets. Now, there are also new risks emerging in the housing market, right? So if you look back at the financial crisis, for example, in this case, household financial positions are much stronger, right? There's increased net worth, the increased real estate equity, and that's because lower rates, because of income support. Now, by contrast, in the run-up to the GFC, the global financial crisis, we have seen loose underwriting standards. We have seen households with low credit score that were able to have access to finance. In this case, we haven't seen that. So those are like positive signs that reassure us. At the other hand, there are also some new risks, right? For example, non-bank mortgage lenders in the United States have become much more prominent, right? Those are not banks. They play an important role in the market, in the mortgage origination market. They do not retain mortgages on their balance sheet. They sell them to government-sponsored enterprise, but they don't have deposits. They fund themselves in wholesale funding markets. So, and there's a high degree of concentration, so making essentially the market more susceptible to stress should financial conditions tighten.
So the report includes some analytical chapters, as it always does, this time on two topics of particular interest, given the times. One is crypto assets and the move toward digital currencies, which the pandemic seems to have accelerated to a certain degree. And the other is climate change. What are the big risks that you see associated with these trends?
So maybe let me start with the crypto chapter, right? So the chapter focuses on the crypto ecosystem and possible financial stability challenges. Obviously, crypto assets come in different flavors. They've evolved to meet various needs, both speculative investment, store of value, currency conversion, payments. Now, we don't believe the financial risks are systemic at this point, but they still need to be closely monitored, given particularly the global implication and the inadequate operation and regulatory frameworks in a number of jurisdictions. Challenges are operational and financial integrity risk from crypto asset providers, investor protection issue from crypto asset and decentralized finance, as well as inadequate reserve and disclosure for some stablecoin. Plus, it's a particular emerging market angle where the advent of crypto assets has accelerated or may accelerate what we call cryptoization, and so circumvent exchange rate and capital control restriction. The third chapter focuses on the investment fund sector and the role that this sector can play to foster the transition to a green economy. We believe that it can be an important driver of the transition to a green economy, but it's still too small in terms of size and scope to have a major impact. And there are also challenges related to greenwashing, right? So just to put some numbers, that the sustainable finance, the asset under management of sustainable investment funds, it's about $3.6 trillion at the end of 2020, and only $130 billion of that total is for climate. And the sample in our, the overall sample of us of asset manager we look at is $50 trillion or $49 trillion. Now, there are positive. I think that's the good news of this of this chapter, that funds flows into sustainable finance support climate stewardship, right? So investor resolution in favor of climate issues, as well as they encourage the issue of securities by firms with favorable ratings. So those are good things. One of the challenges that we highlight in a survey of asset manager that we did is that the lack of adequate data, climate data. That's a key obstacle in implementing investment strategies. And so to conclude, what should policymakers do here? And I think this is important going to COP26 in a few weeks. I think one, they should urgently strengthen the global climate information architecture. So climate data, disclosure, and climate classification, both for firms, so corporates, and investment funds. Number two, they should ensure proper regulatory oversight in order to prevent greenwashing. Number three, once all these elements are in place, they should consider tools to channel savings toward transition funds, right? So for example, financial incentive for investment in climate funds. That should be considered to complement other climate mitigation measures such as carbon tax. And then finally, to mitigate the financial stability risk during the transition, policymakers should implement a climate policy that is consistent with an orderly transition, and so conduct scenario analysis and stress testing for the investment fund sector.
Fabio Natalucci, Deputy Director of the IMF Monetary and Capital Markets Department and Head of the Global Financial Stability Report, the latest of which was published earlier today. Always a pleasure, Fabio. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
If you're interested in learning more about the analytical chapter on crypto assets, there's a podcast on that too. Check it out at imf.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You'll find the latest Global Financial Stability Report, as well as all the other IMF flagship reports, including the World Economic Outlook, at imf.org. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.